So welcome, everybody. This is another edition. I don't actually know which number edition it is of the Conversations with Dr. Cowan and Friends. And today I am really honored and welcome my friend Stephanie Seneff. And Stephanie, I usually say something rather than say you're teach at MIT, and that's sort of all I remember anyways. I like to say something about how I heard about you or our connection, if that's okay.
That's great. Sure.
And I always tell the guests that if you hear anything you don't agree with, you can correct me if I'm wrong. So I don't remember when it was, but it was a number of years ago, maybe 6 or 8 or 7 or so. I remember getting a call from Sally, and she sent me an article that you had written. And she said, "Tom, you really got to read this." And I hear, you know, I get a lot of articles and I get a lot of stuff. And I must admit, most of them I don't like very much. And so I remember reading it, thinking, okay, you know. And I remember thinking, this person knows something. And I think it was soon after that, it had to do with cholesterol and sulfur. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I usually think this person knows something, I started taking MSM like the next day. I realized that this person knew something that I needed to pay attention to. And then I heard your a lecture you gave. And again, I don't usually go to that many lectures, but I must say I was unbelievably impressed with the depth of your insight and the way you could communicate it. And I don't say that about that many people, but it sure seemed to be true with you. So that's how I got to know you.
I love the science. I just love it. And it's what keeps me going. I feel like the world is falling apart, but the science is amazing. And we're getting windows into the biology by virtue of the way it's being destroyed by the environmental toxins. So it's, you know, the toxins are helping us to figure out how biology works.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. So let me tell you what I'd like to do today and see if this is okay. I have basically 4 topics that I'll tell you. And I think the best way to do it is just introduce, is just say the topics and let you start. And then my role is going to be when I hear something that I don't think I understand, I'm going to interrupt and say, "I don't think I really know what you're talking about here." And okay. I think probably if I don't understand it, that I may not be the only one. So if that's okay with you, that's how I'd like to do it.
Okay. And I may kind of wander off topic if I see that it can connect to something else that I'm very, very interested in, if that's okay with you.
That is fine. Okay. So the 4 subjects, and I don't have a time frame. Number one is, so why is glyphosate so bad for you?
Okay, that's
number
easy.
2 is I read a brilliant paper, I think you read, maybe it was a lecture I saw. It had to do with the circulation and how water and I think electrical influences impact circulation. And as you know, that's a huge interest of mine.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So that was number 2. Number 3 was something to do with what is the difference between vitamin D and sunshine?
Okay, yeah.
And then number 4, if we get there, is what's the connection between biodiesel and what we're calling COVID-19?
A great topic. Okay.
Well, are those 4 okay?
That sounds great, yes.
All right, Stephanie, what's the big deal about glyphosate?
Glyphosate is, in my opinion, the most dangerous chemical in our environment today. And the reasons for that are several. I think the main thing is that it's extremely pervasive. It's by far the most used herbicide on the planet. The United States uses substantially more than other countries. So we're king of glyphosate. We use more than anybody else per person. And the United States has a lot
of... And herbicide is something that kills plants, right?
It's not kills plants, yeah. It kills all plants except those that have been engineered to resist it. And of course, they've got this GMO engineering figured out so they can produce plants that are resistant. And so there's several major core crops, you know, soy and corn and canola and sugar beets and alfalfa, those are all engineered to resist it, so they can be very careless about spraying the poison all over the crop and the crop doesn't die. The weeds die, the crop doesn't. So it's a very efficient way to grow crops, but the crop soaks it up and puts it into the food supply. And worse than that, they're spraying several non-GMO foods with glyphosate right before the harvest, such as wheat and oats and garbanzo beans, all the legumes, some of the nuts. I mean, many, many crops are being sprayed right before harvest as a desiccant. So they're using glyphosate to dry the crop out to make it easier, synchronize the yield, because like with wheat, it'll go to seed when it gets hit with glyphosate, and that'll increase the yield. Unfortunately, the glyphosate goes into the seed. So you actually, wheat germ has a very high levels of glyphosate, and it's a very healthy food normally. But people are eating all kinds of foods that are contaminated with glyphosate. That's become clear because, not because the U.S. government is testing it, which they're not, but it's because of organizations, you know, like the Environmental Working Group and Moms Across America. Those people are testing it and finding it in all kinds of foods that are very popular with children. So we're being poisoned with glyphosate every day when we eat. I think the food is the main source for people who don't live right next door to the farm where it's being sprayed. I mean, those people have got a serious problem with the lungs, exposure to the lungs and the skin.
So when you say it's poisonous to any plant, so we're talking everything from weeds to apple trees to tomato plants to anything.
Yeah, they'll all be killed by glyphosate. And the argument is that they've identified a particular gene that gets affected, a particular protein that gets affected by it, which is called EPSP synthase. It's in the shikimate pathway. Shikimate pathway is a pathway that doesn't exist. The whole pathway doesn't exist in human cells. And certainly that enzyme doesn't exist. And that's why they say this is so fantastic, because we don't have that enzyme, so we're not sensitive to glyphosate. It's a lovely story.
You know, right. And you hear all the time that there's no way that glyphosate could be at all toxic, because it works through interfering, you might say poisoning, this thing called the shikimate pathway, which I think it's a series of biochemical steps, right?
Yes, exactly. It's a whole series of steps that ends up producing the aromatic amino acids, tryptophan, tyrosine, and phenylalanine. And those are three of the coding amino acids, and they're essential because we don't have a pathway, we can't make them. So we depend upon either our food supply or our gut microbes to produce those for us. And so if the gut microbes are being affected, then we're going to be deficient in those aromatic amino acids. That's one thing. Because it does affect our gut microbes, and that's the thing they're overlooking.
So technically speaking, they may be correct that it doesn't, because we don't have the shikimate pathway. It doesn't affect us, except if you forget about the fact that us includes microbes.
Exactly, but also, in my opinion, it affects much more than the shikimate pathway. And what I have worked out is an insidious cumulative mechanism of toxicity that I believe is happening. And I learned this by studying how it affects that enzyme. They really study that enzyme quite carefully, EPSP synthase, and they've determined that there's a glycine residue. So glyphosate is a glycine molecule. Glycine is the smallest amino acid. And glyphosate is a complete glycine molecule, except it has extra material stuck on its nitrogen atom. There's an extra methyl phosphonate for you chemists stuck onto its nitrogen atom. It makes a huge difference in its properties. But it still fits into the slot where the glycine fits to be able to assemble into the protein. So glycine is a coding amino acid. The amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. That's the DNA code that dictates which amino acid to put next. When the protein synthesis machinery is trying to assemble a protein and it comes upon glycine, there's a chance it's going to put glyphosate there instead. This is what I think.
Yeah. So in other words, we're building the materials, the proteins that make our bodies, out of amino acids. Mm-hmm. And one of the amino acids called glycine. And it's nice if you're going to build a Lego tower that all the Lego pieces are the proper Lego pieces.
Exactly.
If you've got one with a big old horn sticking out the end of it, you might end up making a tower that doesn't work properly.
Exactly, exactly. That's a really good metaphor. And that explains very well what's going on with EPSP synthase, because they have found, first of all, they found that glyphosate, you know, so they've made all kinds of other, even 1,000 different molecules that are sort of like glyphosate, you know, sort of similar biophysically, but same size, same negative charge, same sort of shape, and they don't work. They don't suppress the enzyme at all. So they're puzzled that only glyphosate works. If as soon as it's not an amino acid analog of glycine, it stops working completely. And in fact, on the other side of it, if you change that glycine in the DNA code for the protein, and they've done this, they've used CRISPR technology to take a corn gene that has EPSP synthase, they take the corn gene, they replace that glycine with alanine. And this is the first thing they did. They're trying to make a version, a CRISPR version of the corn's own EPSP synthase that would be resistant to glyphosate. And sure enough, they replace that glycine with alanine, a code change in the DNA, all of a sudden it has no sensitivity to glyphosate whatsoever. So that glycine that's very highly conserved at that active site binds to a phosphate in PEP. Phosphoenolpyruvate is a substrate, you know, it's a product, I guess, but it, where it binds to PEP and where it binds to the phosphate in PEP is where that glycine is. And they know that, they believe that glyphosate is substituting for PEP as a substrate, but I think they're wrong. I think it's substituting for glycine in the protein. And that is a much, much bigger problem because it can do that in other proteins as well.
So basically any protein that has glycine, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think maybe most, if not all of them do, because it's such a ubiquitous amino acid and it's so small that because it's like messing with the letter A in the alphabet.
Exactly so. And you can imagine all the words that would be misspelled if you changed A to B, you know, everywhere in the words. It would be
right. So you could maybe mess with Z and get away with it.
Exactly.
But if you mess with A, you can't have an apple anymore, and you can't have alphabet, and you can't have language. And then if you can't have language, you don't do well. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And so what's really fun is to go around finding proteins that not only have a highly conserved glycine, that if you change that to something else, the person's very sick. And you can find all kinds of proteins that have glycines that are essential. You can just rummage through the research literature and find those, you know. Yeah. You can find glycines that get mutated and it's lethal. The person dies at birth. I mean, there's some really horrible things that can happen when glycines get changed in certain proteins. But there's more than that, because if the protein also binds phosphate, or especially if it binds PEP, you can find proteins that have exactly the same setup as EPSP synthase. A glycine residue binding phosphate, and sometimes phosphate of PEP, but all kinds of important molecules, small molecules contain phosphate, as you know, such as ATP, for example.
Yeah.
So that's pretty major. Myosin binds ATP. Myosin is a muscle contractile protein. If you change the glycine at the place where it binds ATP to alanine, then all of a sudden the protein doesn't work anymore.
So with that then, What might one see when one is exposed to glyphosate as far as a change in the actual symptoms or health of the person?
Well, there you go. What you see is you see autism, you see Alzheimer's, you see metabolic syndrome, you see gut problems, you see liver problems, you see heart problems, you know, you see diabetes, you see obesity, you see all of those. And all of those are going up dramatically in step with the rise in glyphosate on core crops. I think glyphosate is the primary reason why we have an epidemic in all these diseases. You look at Americans, and Americans have a huge problem with obesity.
Yeah.
Like 37% of our population is obese.
Can you say quickly like how glyphosate might cause somebody to be obese?
Yeah, well, so, you know, I'm looking into it, right? I do believe it's causing it, and I have some theories about how a couple of enzymes, couple of proteins that I suspect are playing a major role. One of them is a very interesting protein called PEPCK, phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase. PEPCK, that protein enzyme is really, really important. It bridges between the mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation generating ATP, you know, the citric acid cycle. Yeah. And then it actually supports gluconeogenesis, the production of glucose from other things in the liver, gluconeogenesis. So the liver can take fats, it can take lactate, it can turn them into sugar. And it does that, you know, when you're eating a high fat diet, for example, you need to get those turned into sugar, or at least that's part of what you do to keep the blood sugar high. So when the blood sugar goes low, when you get into a dangerous situation, you go into a coma because your blood sugar is too low. Maybe you've been working out and you're burning up sugar. You need to turn on gluconeogenesis to get that sugar back. And if you don't do that, you will get into a coma. And I think actually it's contributing to a sudden infant death syndrome in babies, that when the kid finally learns to sleep through the night, It gets into 3 o'clock in the morning, it's got no sugar left in its blood and it can't generate sugar. PEPCK turns on dramatically at birth because all of a sudden the kid's not getting, you know, sugar from the mom's blood anymore.
So it cuts off the alternative pathways that we humans make sugar. And so am I correct in saying if you're in that situation, somehow you get the signal that I need to eat more sugar to keep myself going? And so, of course, you do, because that's what your body is telling you. And right. The next thing you know, you turn that sugar into fat and you're called obese.
Yeah, and you can't convert that fat into sugar because that protein's broken.
Uh-huh.
And so you end up storing fat in your body, right. Can't get it out. And even the protein that, so there's a lipase, you know, a hormone-sensitive lipase that's in the fat cells. And that guy's got glycine dependencies as well. So if it gets disrupted, what it does is it releases the fat and allows it to be circulated and metabolized when based on some hormone stimulation from things like, I think it's adrenaline, for example. So yeah. Certain hormones will trigger it to release those fats to be supplied for energy. And it can get busted too. And then the fat cell can't get the fat out. But when the PEPCK is disrupted, PEPCK disruption in the muscle cells is amazing. And in fact, there's this fantastic study that's called Born to Run. The main title is Born to Run. It's about these mice that have been engineered to have way too much PEPCK in their muscles. They have huge amounts in their muscles. And those mice are amazing. They're like so energetic. They're running on their run, you know, little thing all the time. Yeah. They burn energy like crazy. They're very thin. They overeat. They eat twice as much as the other mice, but they don't get fat. You know, they're the opposite of chronic fatigue syndrome, right. Basically. So I think metabolic syndrome, when you can't efficiently solve a low blood sugar situation, your body panics with that and it puts a set point higher. So you have chronically high blood sugar because you're anticipating, if I need to have sugar quickly, if I'm working hard, I'm going to go into a coma because I can't get this gluconeogenesis in the liver to work. And the liver gets fatty liver disease because it can't convert the fat. Fatty liver disease is clearly correlated with glyphosate. It's one of the ones that's very strongly correlated. And even mice that were exposed to glyphosate at levels below regulatory limits got fatty liver disease. And humans with fatty liver disease, there was a study that showed that they have high glyphosate in their urine, and the ones with worse disease have more. So it's very, very nicely correlated with fatty liver disease, which makes sense because of this PEPCK, which has exactly the same setup with even the same molecule. The PEP is the thing it binds to at the place where the...
Let me see if I got this, because there was a lot there and I want to keep my listeners up to it. So basically what we're saying is there's a whole lot of pathways here that this molecule interferes not only with your ability to make sugar, and so if you can't make sugar, you have to eat more of it because you're worried that maybe you'll run out because you don't know how to make it anymore.
Right.
And then not only that, but then when you overeat sugar, which I would say is inevitable, and even if you're glyphosate poisoned, it's not a matter of willpower, really. Physiologically, you have to. And then you don't have the enzyme to break down the fat to make sugar out of that. So you're in a continual fat storage mode,
including exactly.
In your liver, which is what we call fatty liver disease.
Is that kind of it? Yeah, and that gets you metabolic syndrome, and it leads to heart disease because then your liver's got so much fat, it starts dumping out lots of LDL particles. So you get high serum LDL. That's another one that's correlated with glyphosate. It's interesting, I did a study where I looked at the hospital discharge data and the number of people who were tagged as having high serum cholesterol upon hospital discharge. And you look at that over time, despite the statin drugs, it's going up, you know, dramatically over time, exactly in step with the rise in glyphosate usage. So we're taking statin drugs because we're being poisoned by glyphosate, I think.
All right. I don't think we've exhausted the topic of glyphosate.
I can't possibly exhaust it. It's so amazing. But I think we've caught the essence of it.
Yeah.
And of course, this is something I'm claiming. The Monsanto folks know that that's the best way to explain how it's affecting that enzyme. There's not another way to explain it, you know, because there are other molecules that disrupt that enzyme by substituting for PEP as a substrate. But those molecules are not affected the way glyphosate is. When you change that glycine, they behave as you'd expect. They get a little worse because it's a little extra bulk there. You replace the glycine with alanine, there's a little extra material there, so it doesn't fit quite as well. But with glyphosate, it kills it completely. It can't do anything to suppress that enzyme once that glycine is not there, because the way glyphosate is doing it is different. Yeah. It's getting into the protein rather than substituting for the substrate. That's a very important difference. I think they must know that, although they're denying vehemently that I could possibly be, this could possibly be true. So they're working very hard to make sure people don't catch on to this. But once you say that's happening, it's amazing how many things it explains. It's just
Right. So we're talking about a mistake in the fundamental building blocks of protein, which is the fundamental building block of life and structure and everything else.
Yeah, and it's a slow kill because it gradually accumulates in various proteins throughout your body. And, it just, you get a slow accumulation. And so various places get disrupted over time in various ways. And depending upon your genetics, certain enzymes are going to be more sensitive than certain others. And so different people have different reactions to it, but it's all the same thing, which is your proteins are getting wrecked by glyphosate.
Got it. Okay. Next topic. So I think you know that I wrote a book saying that the heart is not the pump of the blood, which
I love that chapter, by the way. I read that whole book you and Sally wrote. It's a really fun book, but that chapter was my favorite by far. That was so cool.
So basically what I meant was the heart is not a pressure propulsion device, which means the movement of the blood does not come from pushing of the heart. The heart obviously contracts and expands and contracts. And then I was surprised not so long ago, I heard that you had done some work on the movement of the blood in the capillaries and how that's related to, I think, water and electrostatic or electromagnetic forces. And I would love to hear if you could give us as simple an explanation of what you were driving at with that as possible.
And that's a TEDx talk that I gave several years back.
Right. That's
and so
exactly
that if people want to watch that, they can get a better sense of what I'm talking about. That's so fascinating. I'm so fascinated with the blood. And as you know, cholesterol sulfate plays a central role, in my opinion. And it's an overlooked molecule. There's actually not enough written about cholesterol sulfate. And people are kind of puzzled as to what it's for and all of this kind of thing.
So what is cholesterol sulfate? Tell us.
Yeah. So as you might imagine, it's a cholesterol molecule with sulfate stuck on it.
Right. Sulfate is just a sulfur molecule.
Sulfate is SO4-2, and it's an incredibly important molecule. I've kind of obsessed on it. That was really where I started. When I first started looking at about 12 years ago, I started getting really serious about looking at both heart disease and autism at the same time. And interestingly, I somehow stumbled upon cholesterol sulfate, and I learned that, kids, there's a genetic...
Was there a reason why you chose those two? Did you have a personal experience?
I had a personal reason for heart disease, because my husband has been diagnosed with it. And so... I was interested in it for that reason. He was diagnosed right around that time.
Yeah.
It was a total surprise for us. And, he was put on a statin drug, and that I started getting very interested in statin drugs, and I managed to get him off of it and all of that. But at the same time, I was aware of autism from way back, because back in, early 1980s, I had a friend whose son was diagnosed with autism following a DPT shot. He had a DPT shot, he ran a high fever, a week later he had seizures, and then he was later diagnosed with autism. That planted a seed in my mind about linking vaccines to autism early on, when it was very rare at that time. And so that was my interest in autism. But then I was noticing the rates were going up in around 2005, 2006, 2007 timeframe. The rates of autism were clearly rising. And people were, we're just diagnosing it more. I mean, they always find excuses for why these things are happening. Right now, I mean, it's amazing. Everybody, most people seem to know somebody who has autism, I would say, today, because it's so common.
Yeah. Right.
And when I was a kid, I never met anybody with autism my entire childhood. They just didn't exist. And so I know it's going up dramatically. And I wanted to figure out what was causing that. And I sort of started looking at the vaccines with respect to autism. But I found this, and I've forgotten the name of this condition, it's a genetic disease that is an impaired ability to, it disrupts the ability for the skin to release cholesterol sulfate into the blood, and it causes autism. Those kids have a high rate of autism. The kids who have this, it's not coming to me, it's a syndrome.
Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah, so that really tipped me off to cholesterol sulfate. And then, of course, cholesterol and heart disease, I knew, because that's the whole thing they say, have to lower your cholesterol. And then I started looking into cholesterol. I read a wonderful paper about cholesterol sulfate, which was called something like Cholesterol Sulfate in Human Physiology, What's It All About? Fascinating paper. And he made it very clear he didn't really know what it was going, what was going on with cholesterol sulfate. But there was, it's present in the blood at a fairly high level. Like, I guess the other one that's high is DHEA sulfate. Both of those are quite high in the blood. Those are both sterols that are sulfated, you know, they're sulfated molecules that are normally not water soluble. But the sulfate makes it water soluble. So the skin makes lots of cholesterol sulfate. And I think it's triggered by sunlight. So sunlight helps the skin to make cholesterol sulfate. That's why I'm a very big fan of sunlight exposure. And the
we'll get to that a little bit later. But so basically, how does that connect with the circulation of the blood?
Yeah, it takes a while to get there. But the red blood cells, have cholesterol sulfate in their membranes. And I think they actually, what I think is happening is the red blood cells, they make the cholesterol sulfate, they put it on the, in their membrane. And when they get into the capillaries, they hand it off to the tissues. Cholesterol sulfate very easily moves from one membrane to another. It's really interesting.
It's actually made in the red blood cells.
Yeah, the red blood cells make sulfate and they hook it up with cholesterol and they stick it out into their membrane. And then I think that's a major way to deliver both cholesterol and sulfate to the tissue. So what happens is when it transfers from the membrane to it's sort of like cholesterol in the membrane is sort of deeper inside the membrane. Cholesterol sulfate sort of sticks out.
Yeah.
It sort of more easily pops out. And the sulfate makes it water soluble, so it can actually just leave and go into the water system, whereas cholesterol can't because it's not water soluble. So the sulfate allows the cholesterol to get out of the membrane. And it also allows it to get back into the next membrane on the other side, which is the endothelial cells. So it says, thank you very much for that cholesterol sulfate. And then the sulfate can be taken off and put into the extracellular matrix to beef up the sulfate supply lining the blood vessel. And the cholesterol can be used to help, you know, help the endothelial cell with its cholesterol supply. So it's a mechanism to deliver both cholesterol and sulfate to the endothelial wall in the capillary as the red blood cell goes through. And also as it delivers it, it sheds negative charge. So when it comes out to the other side, it's more positively charged. So it's creating a battery at the same time as it's delivering sulfate. It's losing charge.
So this battery creation is at the level of the capillaries and the tissue.
Yeah, between the artery and the vein. So the arteries have a higher pH than the veins do. That's well known. Veins are more acidic than the arteries. And this may be one way in which that's established because the red blood cell is shedding negative charge as it goes through.
And so, how does this charge differential create flow of the blood?
Well, so the negatively charged red blood cell is attracted to the vein. The hard thing is to get through the capillary because the red blood cell barely fits.
Yeah.
So it there's an electrical pull to try to go. It's just like a battery where you have the negatively charged particle is attracted to the positively charged other side.
Got it. So the negatively charged particle is the endothelial wall. Is that right?
It's the red blood cell. The red blood cell is negatively charged. It's a negatively charged particle and it's pulled towards a cathode because it wants to go to the positive charge place.
And so the veins are more positively charged than the arteries.
Yes, exactly.
So it's as if the veins are acting as a kind of the magnet part.
Exactly, they're pulling.
The red blood cells are like the iron filings.
Exactly,
and
very,
very
good.
They're coming down, and then as they get pulled, the water part of the blood kind of flows along with it. Is that?
Yes. And then the other trick is that the sulfate that you add to the endothelial wall along the way, the red blood cells say, hey, here's your sulfate. It's handing it off, right, in the cholesterol sulfate. And they're populating their extracellular matrix with that sulfate, which is making gelled water. Sulfate makes gelled water. And so they're building this beautiful jello that lines the edge of the capillary. It makes it really slick. It hides all the molecules inside the jello. So you just see this smooth surface of this jello. That the red blood it slides through almost frictionlessly along the smooth jello surface, which is the boundary between the gelled and the liquid water.
So it's like, we've all had the experience that if there's no gel, like if it's too cold for gels, your tongue will like stick to the glass.
Yeah, that's right.
But if there's a gel or even ice skating essentially is on a gel. And so if you have these gels, there's this slide of the red blood cells through the capillaries, they not only slide through, but they get attracted like a magnet to the charge in the vein.
Yeah.
And that brings the water part, the blood part along with it.
Right. And on top of that, that gel creates a negative charge inside the gel and it pushes protons out. So the protons gather at the boundary between the liquid water and the gelled water. That creates a battery along the edge of the capillary.
Wow, yeah.
And that's also a source of energy for the cell. So I think those batteries that are created along all the blood vessels by the gelled water are the electrical supply to the system.
So that's the fuel source, essentially the creation of gelled water and its inherent tendency to have a negative charge.
It sheds protons. It pushes them out.
It sheds protons. That is the fuel source for the system.
That's right. It's really, really beautiful. And when you shine sunlight, especially infrared light, that and this is something that Gerald Pollack has talked about. He has a wonderful paper where he showed that infrared light will make that gelled water grow by a factor of 4. It's amazing. So the infrared actually provides energy to those water molecules, which helps them to form that gel. It's so fascinating.
Yeah. So the stronger, meaning the essentially the thicker molecularly the gel is, instead of 10 layers thick, you get 100 layers.
Exactly. It's a bigger
gel. Then you get a stronger charge, a stronger charge differential, and then increased flow.
That's electricity. So you've basically turned sunlight. It's a solar panel. You've turned sunlight into electricity.
Right. And then, I don't know if you would agree with this, I have long thought that if you don't have flow, you have to do a mechanical constriction of the vessels in order to maintain the flow. And that's what we call high blood pressure.
Ah, yes, yes.
So high blood pressure is a adaptive response to trying to compensate for poor gels and poor sunlight exposure.
I completely agree with you. That's been my feeling, that the high blood pressure is a direct consequence. And in fact, you know, there's this endothelial, I'm going to forget the name. I would have reviewed this if I thought I was going to have to talk about
it. It's all right.
There's some kind of endothelial potential, vascular endothelial. I've almost got it. Something like a vascular endothelial potential. It's a function of the moving charges. So the red blood cells and everything else in there is negatively charged too. You know, those LDL particles, they also have cholesterol sulfate in their membranes, and it's keeping them safe because it's building a gel layer around that lipid particle to protect it from oxidative and glycation damage. So when there's not enough sulfate, those LDL particles become vulnerable to attack and they get oxidized, they get glycated. And that's when you start to have to put them into the artery wall. The macrophages go in there and they take them in and they make the atherosclerosis. That's how you get that sort of fatty artery problem in the heart.
Right. So,
because they don't have enough sulfate.
Yeah. So with all that, I think at least we have some idea, not as well as you, as the mechanism. So I'm sitting at home listening and I think to myself, okay, I have to somehow get this sulfate. And I know that part of the mechanism is through exposure to the sun, but is there something I should eat or something I should take, or should I, rotten eggs have sulfur in it? Should I eat rotten eggs?
Well, there are a lot of foods that have sulfur and I tend to eat lots of those foods. So I'm quite, we have garlic all the time. We put garlic in everything. So I eat lots of garlic. Garlic is an excellent source of sulfur.
So we're talking about sulfur that's found in foods is...
Yes. Yes. Sulfur is what you need to eat. And then you need to have the enzymes that make sulfate working properly. And also the enzymes that transfer sulfate and activate sulfate. There's all these enzymes and pretty much all of them are disrupted by glyphosate, if my theory is right. So I really zeroed in on sulfur being a problem, sulfate in particular being problematic if glyphosate is doing what I think it's doing. Because these enzymes are critically dependent upon upon glycine residues to do their job.
Got it. So number one step is don't eat glyphosate.
Don't eat glyphosate.
And then number two step is what should you eat? There's garlic. So
garlic and all the cruciferous vegetables are great. Brussels sprouts and cabbage and broccoli and cauliflower. Yeah, they're all great. I eat lots of those. And then egg is excellent. Absolutely excellent. It's got a lot of other good things in it too, especially egg yolk.
Yeah.
But the white has some sulfur too, but the yolk is terrific. Egg yolk, you can't eat too much egg yolk. Even, grass-fed beef and all the different seafoods, oysters and clams.
Shellfish or wild seafood.
Are really good sources of sulfur and very good for you in general. These things all have really good nutrients other things besides sulfur that make them healthy.
And is there any reason or sense in any sort of sulfur supplementation? Is there a good one, or are there things you should never do, or?
Well, MSM is one that a lot of people, I talk to people who are clinicians, and they've told me that in fact, my husband even takes MSM. So MSM is it's probably a good source. I mean, methyl sulfonyl methane. So it's got a nice sulfur in there, sort of ready to become sulfate, I suspect. And so I think it's a good, a very popular source. There's a lot of actual supplements that contain sulfur. Alpha lipoic acid is one, for example. Yeah, of course, garlic you can take. N-acetylcysteine and S-adenosyl methionine. So methionine and cysteine, those are both sulfur-containing amino acids. So they're important also.
And, so NAC and something called SAMe, those are sulfur.
Sulfur-containing.
But sort of a supplementation for simple people would just be stick with MSM and you'll probably
And now Epsom salt is the one I really like. Yeah. I like things that are not that are coming in through the skin. So Epsom salt baths, I do that regularly, almost every night. I just put a little. I don't do a huge amount. Because I take a bath every night, and it's just sort of like a free thing to do while I'm taking a bath. It's very nice, very, very hot water. I make it really hot, and I put in a little bit of Epsom salts, maybe like a quarter cup to a half cup.
In a full bath.
Yeah. So it's a small amount, but you know, it dissolves easily, and I feel like it's helpful. I don't know if it is, but that's what I'm doing. And of course, you can take much more than that. And you can even, parents of autistic kids have told me they even make an Epsom salt, you know, a paste, and they put it on their kid's skin. Uh-huh. To get really, really intense concentration of Epsom salts through the skin. The nice thing about Epsom salts is it's already sulfate and it's not going through the gut, because a lot of people have issues with sulfur, especially people who have issues with sulfur. They could do the Epsom salt baths to get sulfate in through the skin, bypassing the gut, because glyphosate messes up the enzymes that make organic sulfur from inorganic sulfur. And what happens is you get an excess of hydrogen sulfide gas in the gut, which is which can be very toxic if it gets too high. And it'll float up to the brain and cause brain fog too. So.
Right. So basically the good food, sunlight, don't eat glyphosate, don't get anywhere near it. Maybe take some MSM if your gut is reasonably healthy, and anybody would probably benefit from regular Epsom salt baths, which is half a cup or quarter of a cup in really hot water for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, or does
10, 15 minutes type
10,
of thing.
15 minutes. All right. Next one, vitamin D versus sunshine.
Yeah. And I wrote a whole paper for the Weston Price Foundation.
Brilliant paper. Everybody should read it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I've been really intrigued by this. You know, it's interesting how the doctors finally figured out that we have a major epidemic in vitamin D deficiency in this country. They figured that out maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and when you look at, I think we even looked at the number of people who were diagnosed with vitamin D deficiency over time from some data set that we had, and it went astronomically up over a short period of time. That's because they suddenly started looking for it. You know, it had been building up, the deficiency problem, but once they started looking for it, more and more people started looking for it.
But isn't there a problem with the test that you can't necessarily diagnose a deficiency based on just a 25 OHD test?
Right. Well, it's complicated, right? Because it gets the liver, so it's made in the skin in response to sunlight. And then it's shipped to the liver, where it's it gets the first step that gets the first hydroxy. So it's 1,25 hydroxy, right, is the final product that is the active one. And the 25 hydroxy is the one that's intermediate. That's the one the liver makes. And then the kidneys do another step to make the 125. And then the 125 is the one that's actually active and signals all kinds of things. What you measure is the 25, which is the one the liver makes. Now, I will tell you that the liver and the kidneys make these modified vitamin D molecules from enzymes called cytochrome P450 enzymes, CYP enzymes. And papers have shown that glyphosate suppresses CYP enzyme activity in the liver. So one of the things I think is happening is simply that the vitamin D is not getting activated because the liver CYP enzymes are broken.
So... And an inactivated vitamin D is a dysfunctional or non-functional vitamin D. And so everything to do with hormone regulation and absorption of calcium and deposition of calcium doesn't work properly because you don't have the, quote, active form of the vitamin D.
Right. And the thing is calcium. So vitamin D, one of the things it does is it mobilizes calcium. So anytime anything in the cell is saying, hey, we need calcium, vitamin D is going to say, here, you can have tons of it. You know, it's just like, here you go, lots of calcium.
Yeah.
And so when the body is sick because of the glyphosate, glyphosate has been shown in multiple studies to induce calcium uptake by cells. It induces calcium uptake. So now when you've got all this vitamin D that you're taking as a supplement, you're encouraging that calcium uptake. So this is calcium uptake into the artery wall to produce calcified plaque.
Right.
Calcified arteries are bad news. That is a very bad risk factor for heart disease.
Yeah.
So you're taking vitamin D, which is helping you to increase the calcification of your arteries, which is not a good thing, you know?
As well as potentially being, well, not potentially, being exposed to a chemical that also at the same time is increasing the uptake and probably the deposition of calcium into the tissues.
Yeah, and also when you eat, those people are taking tons of vitamin D. So we take tons of vitamin D orally, it hits the liver and the liver is stuck either having to turn it into some, you know, to do use the CYP enzyme to do its thing or use that CYP enzyme to do other things that it needs to do, such as making bile acid. So when the liver is busy trying to convert all this vitamin D, it can't, its CYP enzymes are not as available to make the bile acid. So that could actually interfere with the bile acid production, which glyphosate already interferes with it because it disrupts those CYP enzymes.
Right. And I remember, there was an old saying amongst European physicians that the bile cures the bowels. In other words, the reason you have bowel movements and the reason your bowel movements are healthy is essentially because of bile flow. So if you have somebody who's glyphosate toxic or injured or exposed, they already have bowel problems. And then if you add vitamin D onto that, they will make less bile, which
yes.
will make their bowels even worse.
And that's what I would predict. Yeah. Really crazy. I think it's just insane that people are taking these huge doses of vitamin D. There seems to be no limit. I mean, it used to be that doctors would recommend, you know, something much, much more reasonable as a supplementary level. Now they're going like 10,000 units, 20,000 units. I mean, it's crazy. It's out of sight. It's just ridiculous to think you would need that much. And the other thing is, of course, when the skin makes vitamin D, it also makes cholesterol sulfate. So when you take vitamin D as a supplement, you're not taking cholesterol sulfate. If you eat a food that contains vitamin D, it also contains cholesterol sulfate.
Right.
So vitamin D comes with cholesterol sulfate, and to some extent, it's a signaling molecule that says, hey, you've got cholesterol sulfate, but you don't because you're taking it in isolation. So it's lying to you.
Uh-huh.
And that can really mess up your cells because they're acting on false information.
Uh-huh. So then you have confused cells. And again, one of the repercussions you might see is this abnormal calcium deposition, which is everything from gallstones and kidney stones and
exactly.
artery deposition and I think 80, I don't know how many percent of the people have calcified pineal glands and
exactly. It's you're going into all kinds of terrible places and it's to being extracted from the bones because your signaling is saying we need the calcium in the tissues. Let's take it out of the bones. So your bones are actually becoming worse, not better at the same time. You're stealing it from the bones and putting it into the tissues.
Right.
Which is really bad.
So many people may be hearing this and I think they may be thinking to themselves, so is Stephanie saying that I don't think taking vitamin D is a good idea?
I've never taken it. Never taken it as a supplement, but I'm obsessed with sunlight. I have really good, really high vitamin D levels in my blood. So, I have a healthy level of vitamin D. 60, I think, is what
Do you think there's any justification in anybody taking vitamin D as a supplement?
Personally speaking, I would say no.
I
certainly wouldn't take it. Yeah.
So really, what about in the winter and people who live in Massachusetts, for instance?
I know. That's actually where I start to think, I don't know if I can keep on telling these people not to take vitamin D. Of course, I'm lucky. I go to Hawaii in the winter, so I make sure I get plenty of sun. Not everybody can afford to go to Hawaii in the winter. So, and then people ask me, well, should I use a sun lamp, sort of like a full spectrum sun lamp in the winter? And I hesitate there too, because, those things can cause skin cancer. So I think if I were stuck in a place where there wasn't a lot of sun in the winter, first of all, I would stock up as much as possible in the summer, try to get a really good tan because you can store it, you can.
Right. Isn't there some logic in thinking, first of all, it's fat soluble, so it's going to be stored. And there must be something adaptive about human beings and probably other animals, going through a cycle of storing it, you know, right, making sure they're replete, and then maybe there's something good about having less in the winter.
It could very well be that we've adapted, right? People who live up north have adapted to this cycle that they get a lot of vitamin D in the summer, and then they have to store it for the winter, and then they come back out, you know, in the spring and pick it up again. Yeah. And also you can get it from foods. I don't like to get it from vitamin D supplemented foods. I've seen orange juice supplemented with vitamin D, and if I see that, I won't buy it.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous to put vitamin D in orange juice. And they put it in milk.
Any truth in like if you eat, since vitamin D is fat soluble, and if you have a pig, for instance, that's out in the sunlight, exactly, all summer and spring and maybe fall,
yes,
they would likely have more vitamin D in their fat, i.e.
That's lard. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And we use organic lard mainly for cooking, you know, for frying foods, organic lard. That's our favorite fat.
Yeah.
Butter is probably
like pasture raised. Chip.
Yeah, well, organic lard, it's hard to find, but there is a company that sells it on the web. So it's
a pig fed and organic kind of vitamin diet. D supplement.
It's say it again.
That would be almost like a vitamin.
Yeah, exactly. So I would eat foods that contain vitamin D in the winter. So bacon and lard, use lard in cooking, and probably eggs and milk, if you could get raw milk. Raw milk would be great. Of course, they destroy the vitamin D in the milk, and then they add back in, I think they add in vitamin D2, which is ridiculous because D3 is what you need.
Right.
I don't like milk because it's so processed, you know.
Right. So we don't want any. So we're only looking for, obviously, if the animal isn't out in the sun, it's not going to do any good. So we want animals in the sun.
Yes.
Eating their natural food, whatever that animal happens to be, and
they will store
vitamin D in their fat, and that's the part that we want to eat.
Right. So grass-fed beef, for example, the fat of grass-fed beef. So that you can use that as well. The beef tallow, I think it's called, right?
All right. We've got 10 more minutes or so.
Okay. COVID-19.
Is there anything? I've seen some very interesting things you've written. Correct me again if I'm wrong, that some of the places, I don't even know, maybe all of that, where there's sort of hot spots or people getting sick, have been places where there have been a switch to biodiesel, meaning they're actually taking, glyphosate, grown corn and making that into fuel. And obviously it gets spewed into the air, and that may be a contributing factor in people getting sick.
That's right. That's what I'm thinking. In fact, I've really enjoyed looking at the epidemiology of COVID-19. It's really, really fascinating. And one thing you'll notice if you look at the globe is that Africa is somehow immune to COVID-19. It's quite remarkable. Nigeria. So air pollution is something that was found to be correlated. So there've been multiple studies. There was a Harvard group that did a nice study looking at all the counties across the United States, and saw that those places that had higher levels of these particles, nanoparticles in the air, had increased death rate from COVID-19. I always look at death rate, not the infection rate, because the infection rate is highly variable depending upon how many tests you're doing.
Yes,
and all that
has
sort of
to do with the phony test.
Yeah, so death rate's a more reliable number. And so looking at death rate associated with air pollution, these Harvard researchers found this strong correlation. And then there's also three other papers I found from Europe, one from the UK, one from multiple people from various mainland Europe. You know, so three different, I think it's one from Italy. There were three different papers from Europe that showed, again, correlation between air pollution and COVID-19, death rate from COVID-19. So something in the air. Now you go to Nigeria. Nigeria is extremely, extremely interesting because it has one of the lowest rates of COVID-19 death rate in the world. It has 1/100th of the rate death rate that we have. So it's not a small difference, 1 in 100. Now, part of it is that they have fewer old people. Yeah, and people say, well, maybe it's just because they have fewer old people, but it's 1 in 5 old people and 1 in 100 death rate. So even if you said everybody who died was old, there's still a 1 in 20 factor there.
Yeah.
In a country that has extreme air pollution problems, they have some of the worst air pollution in the world. They have crowding in the inner cities. They have 100%, almost 100% black population, very black. So that vitamin D might be a reason with the blacks. The blacks in America have twice the death rate of the whites, and they don't know why. One possibility is because of their dark skin, they don't get enough vitamin D.
Yeah.
Well, in Nigeria, you've got, very dark blacks. Very high poverty rate, very great deal of crowding in the inner city, very high air pollution. All these things are risk factors for COVID-19. And they don't have COVID-19. It's quite amazing. You know, there's something weird going on there, right?
So, yeah. So what's the difference?
So I think it's glyphosate. I think the air pollution is, air pollution is not a problem with COVID-19 if there isn't glyphosate in the air pollution. That's what my theory is. That's my working theory. And when you look at the places.
Glyphosate in the air pollution.
A glyphosate in the air pollution. Yeah. And so that's where you look at New York City, which is, you know, I first looked at Lombardy because that's where it first took off in Europe, in Lombardy. Now, Europe has very high buy-in of diesel fuel in automobiles. They have like 20% of their cars are diesel. And Europe is a leader in the biodiesel industry. So they're putting biodiesel into those cars mixed in with the regular diesel.
Right.
And your U.S. doesn't have that much diesel in their cars. I mean, we have diesel trucks, you know.
Yeah.
And diesel buses. The New York City is a leader in the biodiesel industry. Biodiesel has blossomed in the last few years. It's really growing as an industry. They're really learning how to do it well. It's reducing the price. It's becoming more cost effective. And of course, everybody loves it because it's climate change, right? You're trying to reduce the consumption of the fossil fuels by switching to these biofuels, which are being generated every year by growing crops. And it's quite interesting. And I learned a lot about biofuels because of this interest. And they like, for example, they grow the wheat. They spray the wheat with glyphosate right before harvest. They harvest the wheat, and then they take the stalks and they throw it onto a barge, take it down to New York City and run it through a processing that turns out this biofuel. It can be biogas, biodiesel, bioethanol. There's bioaviation fuel. There's home heating fuel. New York City is the only place in the world that I've found that requires 5% bio in your home heating fuel if you heat your home with this heating oil.
And all of this raw material, all these stocks and all the stuff that they're putting into the diesel, the biodiesel generators, these are glyphosate spray crops with glyphosate in the actual tissues of the plants.
Exactly. And now you're burning that. And, you know, so it doesn't get completely burned up. It doesn't get completely converted into what you're trying to convert into. So you have methane gas, which I think you've got glyphosate molecules in that. It actually is effervescing into the methane gas and showing up there. Now you're breathing it. So I think it's when people are breathing glyphosate that they're especially susceptible to COVID-19, because the glyphosate is disrupting the lungs specifically. It's causing toxicity in the lungs. There was a very interesting article I read about, it was a case study of a guy who had used an applicator to spray glyphosate-based herbicide on his crops. The applicator got clogged up. So he took it and he got a bucket of diesel fuel to use as a solvent to clean his product. And he was inside, he was really stupidly working inside with this diesel fuel and this glyphosate. He was cleaning his product and he started coughing up blood. And he was rushed to the hospital with pneumonitis. He was diagnosed with pneumonitis just from breathing the air that was the combination of the diesel fuel and the glyphosate. So I think the diesel fuel acts as an adjuvant to make the glyphosate more toxic.
Got it.
It's helping to get the glyphosate into the tissues.
Yeah. So it's sort of an inoculation of glyphosate into already irritated tissues because of the pollution and other irritants in the air.
Yeah. So and you got those nanoparticles. They could be trapping glyphosate. There's been a theory that the nanoparticles trap viruses, and that helps to keep the virus contagious for a longer period.
Yeah.
That's one of the explanations they're trying to use for why those nanoparticles are causing increased risk. But they're not causing increased risk in Nigeria. They've got plenty of nanoparticles in their air, and it's not causing increased risk. So there's something fishy going on there, you know?
Right. So you can, you know, not that it's good, but you can get away with putting particulate matter in the air as long as it doesn't have glyphosate in it.
Yeah, I know. It's quite interesting that Nigeria, really, people should be studying Nigeria deeply because it's quite mysterious.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, there's several countries in...
even though they have low vitamin D levels because there's no
they're
sun.
Dark skin. Yeah, no sun because of all the pollution. Yeah, but it turns out that when I started to look at obesity, and obesity, of course, is a very strong risk factor for a bad outcome for COVID. A lot of the young people who are dying are obese.
Yeah.
And all these diseases that are risk factors are all things that are going up exactly in step with glyphosate usage on poor crops. So I think basically glyphosate exposure is the primary risk factor. The more you've been exposed to glyphosate throughout your life, the more susceptible you are to dying from COVID-19. And I can explain why based on all those proteins, because glyphosate So collagen is a protein that has huge amounts of glycine, GXY, GXY, GXY. Every third amino acid is a glycine, long swaths of the molecule. And there are these proteins that the lung produces, these surfactant proteins, that have a collagen-like stalk. So they have a stalk that's made up of this GXY, GXY sequence. And they've been studying vaping. You know, vaping is causing a lung disease. It looks a whole lot like COVID-19.
Yeah.
Smoking e-cigarettes. And vaping has the base molecule that the nicotine is dissolved in is glycerol. And glycerol is a major byproduct of the biofuel industry. So we have a glutted market of glycerol. It's very cheap right now because it's coming out of all these biofuel
projects. So vaping itself also is another way of exposure to glyphosate.
You're smoking glycerol with glyphosate in it. That's what I suspect. And that's killing your lungs. And so people who vape have a fivefold. Most of the people who vape are young, so they have, you know, much lower risk. But they have a fivefold. There was a recent paper that came out. They have a fivefold increased risk to COVID-19 if they vape. That makes sense because the glyphosate has been poisoning their lungs.
Got it.
And this surfactant protein is really important for trapping the viruses. And the study on the mice where they exposed them to vaping fumes, they had reduction in these surfactant proteins. They pointed that out, that they suspected somehow the vaping fumes, they didn't know how, were disrupting these proteins that have this GXY sequence in them.
Yeah.
And preventing them from going into the surfactants and preventing them from being able to trap the viruses. So the viruses are just running free. Nobody can trap them in the lungs. And so they flourish.
Probably don't even need a virus theory in that, because you're just damaging the lungs and all that. Stephanie,
yeah.
Is there any final words you want to give our listeners? Like,
I really hope that COVID-19 allows people to recognize what's going on, because it's so dramatic to me. People are puzzled about the differences. Why is Africa so immune to it? You know, if they would just wake up and realize this connection, it is so clear to me that that's what's going on. And I'm hoping that they will eventually, and that we'll recognize the U.S. is getting clobbered by COVID-19 because we've got so much glyphosate. If we just got rid of our glyphosate, we'd be so much better off.
Yeah. So the moral of the story is, get out in the sun, eat real food from pastured animals, and stay as far as you can away from glyphosate.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
All right, Stephanie. It's a pleasure to have you with us here, and thank you very much. And I just keep on doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Okay, Stephanie. Take care.